This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. George Floyd's funeral was held this week in Houston. He was remembered as a father, a brother, a mentor, and an athlete. Here's Cyril White. He recruited George Floyd to play on his exhibition basketball team in the late 90s.
The coaches would ask me, who's your big man? I would say, George Floyd. They say, oh, you got Big Floyd. Okay, well, your team must be pretty good.
Floyd played college basketball at what was then known as South Florida Community College, and his death at the hands of police has inspired a loud response from the sports world. Last week, North Carolina Central head men's basketball coach Lavelle Moten called out college coaches who make millions a year off the talents of young, mostly black athletes, and yet don't speak up against racism and police brutality. Here he is on ESPN Radio.
It's not the blatant racism that we can't deal with. That's easily identifiable. But it's the guys that's pretending to say they love and care for us that's not speaking up on our behalf. That's the danger.
Moten's perspective wasn't born of recent news. It's the product of a lifetime of experiences. Coach Moten, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
So I'd like you to start with the first time you had a negative interaction with the police.
You guys are in Boston, correct?
Yes.
Well, I grew up in Roxbury in a housing project called Orchard Park. And at an early age, my mom migrated down to Raleigh, North Carolina. So I would say my first instance was I was 12 years old. Back then, I wanted to go on AAU trips. And in order to fund my AAU trips, I would always go sell magazine subscriptions. So I knew to go to the affluent neighborhoods. And this particular day, I'm coming back, and I had a good day. I'm selling magazine subscriptions and everything. And as I'm walking back home, I'm counting my money, and a cop, he's probably driving 3-4 miles an hour while I'm walking. And the first thing he says is, boy, where you get that money from? He rolled down his window, and I didn't answer because, you know, I at that age, and even now, I'm nobody's boy. Like, I just thought that had a negative connotation to it. And as I continued to walk, he continued to drive. He said, boy, did you hear what I said? Where did you get that money from? That's crack money, ain't it? And I said, no, this ain't no crack money. Like, it's magazine subscription money. And I knew no 12-year-old tells a cop that it's magazine subscription money. So he cut me off. He got out the car and made me spread eagle. And he checked my pockets, and I think he was checking for drugs, you know, crack, because this was the inception of the crack era, right? So this is the mid-80s that I'm telling you about. And he reached in my back pocket, he took my money, and then he took the rest of it out of my hand. And I remember going home, and I was crying to my mom, and I wasn't crying because I was violated by him. I was more so crying because I didn't think I would be able to go on my AAU trip simply because he took my money.
All right. So let's fast forward about 20 years to 2005. You were in Raleigh and in a car with Raymond Felton. And just a few months before this incident, Felton had helped to lead UNC to an NCAA title.
Felton, long three. That wasn't only beyond the arc. That was beyond the arch here in St. Louis.
Can you describe what happened that night?
I have a black Yukon Denali, and the windows are kind of tinted, and I'm in my old neighborhood, and I was coming from visiting some friends, and I'm on the phone with my mom, and I see in my rear view a car following me, a cop car, and I say, Mom, I'm gonna call you back because I'm being followed and I know I'm about to be pulled. And she said, no, you stay on the phone with me. And I knew what was about to happen, and I didn't want her to have to, you know, live any of that. So he put his lights on and I pull over. And I instantly put my phone on speaker because I knew it was about to be something, because I wasn't speeding. I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was just driving. So by the time I put it in park, you know, he rushes up to the door and tries to yank me out the door. I don't go all the way because I still have my seatbelt on. So I unclick my seatbelt, and then he yanks me out the car. And when he yanks me out the car, his backup partner has a gun to my head and said, turn your black around. So I turn around. And I got my hands on the car, and I'm looking like, yo, what are y'all doing? Mind you, it's no protocol, no routine, no driver's license, no registration, like none of that stuff. They just went straight from 0 to 100. And so the initial officer is kicking my ankles, trying to get me to spread my legs open. And he's touching my pockets. He was like, you got dope in that car. You got dope in that car, hon. You got y'all dope boys, you dope boys. And it was a rather nice truck at the time. And I was like, no, we ain't no dope boy. He's like, let me search the truck. I said, you're not searching my truck. Like, what you talking about? But so each time I turn around to a address him because he's talking to me. He's asking me questions. His partner brings the gun closer and closer to my head. So my mom is panicking and she's going crazy on the phone. And he cuffed me. He took me by my head, led me to the back of the truck and slammed me down on the ground. And now I'm sitting down. But mind you, I have on all white and it's raining outside. Right. And each time he's asking me to still search my console and so forth, he's deliberately like kicking mud and residue on me, just basically trying to humiliate me as he asks me a question and so on and so forth. So his backup comes, and when his backup arrives, he pulls up to the curb and he's probably 5 feet away from me. And he get out the car and he got his gun drawn because he see his partner's guns drawn. And so the backup officer had a partner with him and he got out the car as well. And he's starting to look at me with a sense of familiarity, right? And so they go huddle up and I know they're talking about me because they're all looking back at me. And he comes over, he said, "Man, what is your name?" And I said, "Lavelle Moulton, man. I've been," and he said, "Man, I thought that was you." He said, I've been trying to tell them that. So he goes back over there, they huddle up. And the guy, the initial officer, come back and say, "Let me see your driver license and registration." And I said, "You're supposed to ask that initially. I'm not reaching in this car for you to have a built-in excuse to kill me." I said, "No, I'll tell you my driver's license number. I memorized my driver's license number since I was 15 years old, right?" And so I told him that. And he go back and he get in the car, I guess, and he runs the license plates and so on and so forth. And by this time, Raymond, they still don't even know Raymond is in the car at this time, right? This is the craziest thing. So he rolls down the window and he said, "Big bro, just calm down." And so now they're running up to the passenger side with their hand on their gun because he scared them. And when they run up to his side, they recognize him. And down here, every basketball player at North Carolina, Duke, and NC State is highly recognizable, right? And they recognize Raymond. They're like, "Yo, this is Raymond Felton." So again, they huddled up and the officer came up and he extended his hand and said, "Man, want to apologize." He said, "We got a call that y'all fit the description." So I just sat there and he uncuffed me. They eventually let us go. And my mom was crying. And I remember like it's the first time I felt less than a man when I was a grown man at the hands of another man. It was almost like all of the stories my grandfathers and my great uncles and all the elders in my neighborhood always told me, I instantly became one of them. I wasn't any different. I had the same experience to share.
So I want to go back for just a second. Can you explain how it is you came to memorize your driver's license number? Because it never would occur to me to do that.
Yeah, well, it's common practice. You know, where I'm from, we call them OGs. There's older gentlemen and their mentors. I had my permit and one of them was helping me teach me how to drive. And he said, "Look, always remember your driver's license number, because there will come a time where you will be pulled by law enforcement and you don't need anyone saying they have probable cause to shoot or do any physical damage to you because they believed you were reaching for a gun or some kind of weapon."
You coach at North Carolina Central, which is an HBCU, and as I understand it, you have these sorts of conversations with them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's my moral obligation because one day the ball is going to stop bouncing. And as a head coach, it's my job to prepare you for what awaits you, and that's a real world.
And you actually practice what you should do when you get pulled over by a cop?
Yeah, I'm a teacher at heart. So a lot of people don't know I was a public school educator for 6 years. So everything is a lesson plan to me. And so I have fun with it, you know, in terms of being creative and teaching them the principles of manhood, but also how to conduct themselves in the world and how situation and scenarios will arise with them, whether they like it or not. And they have a responsibility in it as well. So I tell them, memorize your driver's license number. Ask two times before he asks you to reach for your registration or whatever it is. Ask for permission two times. Always address him as sir, regardless of his tone, so he know and he can't ever use against you that, you know, you're being vocal and, you know, antagonizing and things of that nature.
What's it like to have those conversations? Those can't be joyful or fun conversations to have.
Yeah, but it's normal. It's our normal everyday existence, right? It's who we are. And unfortunately, it's the harsh realities of this world and what not only myself, but many people of color have to deal with, you know, both male and female. Now I have to pull my 7-year-old and 11-year-old to the side and inform them, look, yeah, this is a rated R video, but you got to watch it because this is what you have to, unfortunately, you know, deal with. So it's, to answer the question, it's become a sense of normalcy. It's who we are. It's our makeup. It's our DNA. It's one of the many obstacles that we face as Black men as we go out and try to thrive in this world on a day-to-day basis.
You called on college coaches to speak out against racism and police brutality. Many of them did, if you consider carefully worded Twitter posts to be an acceptable form of speaking out. What needs to happen next?
Unity. Let's be honest. It's been a systemic issue in this country for 400 years with people of color. And so it's not Black people's job to solve a problem that they never created in the first place, because if they could solve it, you know, they would have solved it 400 years ago, I'm sure, right? My grandfather and his great grandfather or father would have solved that problem. So we need help. And anytime there's been a change on behalf of Black people and people of color, a lot of people on the front lines that was leading that fight didn't look like us. So we need that, right? And we need everyone to show up in a unified front. And I think that's the beautiful thing about the protests. It's so diverse. It's not just us. People are starting to feel and empathize with what we've been experiencing throughout our entire lives.
Lavelle Moten is the head men's basketball coach at North Carolina Central. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This week on It's Been a Minute, I talk out the news with my Aunt Betty.
I'm more concerned about the Black men that I love than anything in the world, because I just don't want to get that call.
Also, parenting in the age of Black Lives Matter and the history of police reform. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know. We wanted to bring this segment back after a three-month absence because there's so much to discuss, but we're going to do something a little different. Many leaders in the Black Lives Matter movement are saying that this is a moment for white people to do more listening than talking. So we've invited three guests to join us to talk about sports, racism, and police brutality, and I'm really just here to listen. We have a three-professor lineup today. Penn State Professor Amira Rose Davis, Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and The Washington Post's Kevin Blackstone, who also serves as Professor of the Practice at the University of Maryland. Welcome back to all of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Take it away, Amira Rose.
Yeah, so I have to admit that I'm a little bit of a cynic, and as inspiring as a lot of the images that have been circulating in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, as people have taken to the streets, have been very awe-inspiring in many ways. But when the corporate statements started rolling out, particularly when they were empty words paired with no action or, you know, downright hypocritical, I started side-eyeing a lot of things. So I have to admit, I was caught completely by surprise by NASCAR.
The Confederate flag, a fixture in NASCAR Southern culture for decades, now no longer permitted a place in the sport.
And I don't know what I'm feeling right now. It's like, is this like a little bit of hope?
Prohibited from all NASCAR events and properties, effective immediately.
I mean, if you remember in 2015, after the Charleston massacre, NASCAR said, hey, maybe you shouldn't bring Confederate flags to races. And that didn't hold. It still happened. So have in this moment, NASCAR say we're banning it outright, paired with constant activism by Bubba Wallace. He raced in a Black Lives Matter car this week. So this to me feels, I think, a little different. This is probably the first time in this moment that I've been genuinely shocked by what's happening. And I wanted to know if y'all were just as shocked as I was.
First, I was shocked to be reminded that Bubba Wallace was a brother. That's number one. I'm still wondering what was happening in his early life. I got to look into that. But I think what we need to think about all this, the Confederate statues coming down, the other symbolic things that are happening, is the symbolism of this. But with NASCAR, it's so ingrained as part of who they traditionally are. There is something really different about this. Now, you know, my big concern, the next big story is really enforcing it.
I would say I'm still a little bit cynical. You know, Bubba Wallace has been, he started in NASCAR in 2010. He was asked about this in previous years. And if I'm not mistaken, one of his quotes was, the only flag I care about in NASCAR is the checkered flag.
Diving more into it and educating myself, people feel uncomfortable with that. No one should feel uncomfortable when they come to a NASCAR race.
Josh Newman down at Florida State has written a lot about white supremacy, the Confederacy, and how it has been married into sports. And one of the things that he noted, I remember I wrote about this about 5 years ago, when NASCAR originally came out and said, you know what, don't bring your flags anymore. We're not really about that. They never checked their vendors. And so you could show up at a NASCAR event outside and you could buy whatever Confederate imagery you wanted and drench yourself in it and go right into the racetrack. So, you know, we'll see how well they police that. Are they going to actually be collecting flags at the door, taking caps off of people's heads, making them take off their T-shirts? I mean, I've covered NASCAR, and it's everywhere. So we'll see how they handle it.
Kevin, I really appreciate your point about Bubba's evolution. And I think that that's one of the things we're seeing is the rise of voices like Bubba Wallace and like lay players who perhaps were hesitant to say something before. Certainly, I feel that swell. And I have to ask, you know, Kevin, you've done a lot of work on this. When this happened, it was like, great. Now we're kind of cocking our heads and looking at the Washington football team.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's going to take the courage of football players of color to step up and say, no, this is not acceptable. Dan Snyder and this franchise and the NFL are not going to just roll over. But yes, Roger Goodell, if you're going to make a statement, don't have it be perfunctory by not backing it up and taking care of your own house.
Last thing I say is I think it also requires people to understand that anti-blackness and settler colonialism are wound tightly together. And so this is not, oh, a separate issue, et cetera, but it is to the very fabric of the march towards freedom.
Exactly.
Sounds like a good time to move on to Ken's topic.
Which I think all these topics are so interrelated. I'm the old business school guy, so I've been watching the corporate statements. It's different from any other time I think we've seen. Axios Sports did an analysis, you know, 2 weeks in, 118 of the 123 major sports teams in the U.S., the big four leagues, issued a statement. I mean, really kind of shocking that five had not by that point, James Dolan. And what's interesting to me is how many missed the mark. So the rare category, those who actually focus on police brutality, police misconduct, addressing racism directly rather than using language of diversity and inclusion. This is about police brutality, race, and murder. You can't find those words in most of these statements. For the reasons we understand, these sports leagues and teams are so intertwined with law enforcement that they can't call out their partner. Most striking, and Karen and I spoke about this earlier, was how long it took Major League Baseball amongst the leagues to step out, 9 days to say anything. And I've taken some time to think about that and why did that happen. But Major League Baseball, before they take this down, go to the Major League Baseball website and click on executives. And all you will see is white men standing around Rob Manfred. White men. 2020. And that's not historically the way that office has been. Bud Selig did much better. The NFL did move forward a bit because of the presence and the inclusion of more African Americans in their organization.
I would say the thing that irritated me the most was not necessarily from MLB, but from individual franchises that all seemed absolutely stuck on using Jackie Robinson as their one black friend, which is no different than what the league does generally. It's no different than the way that they use the shield of Jackie Robinson and ignore the words of Jack Robinson, who will tell them about themselves. It was just so stark. They're taking quotes from him to say, we're all in this together. His story lights the way. Meanwhile, you know, Jack Robinson is over here writing 1965 about police power abuse. He has these articles reading. You can do it. It's there. But the constant like commitment to infantilizing him and to reducing him to this symbol so devoid of his actual life to me is annoying any year, all the time in general, but particularly now where I feel like it was giving certain franchises cover. The one thing that I was, I will admit, a little pleased to see was the Red Sox statements affirming Torrey Hunter's experience.
Well, the Red Sox responding tonight to Torrey Hunter, who said he's heard racial slurs directed at him at Fenway Park over his 19-year career. And this is a very powerful statement. It says, quote, "If you doubt him because you never heard it yourself, take it from us, it happens."
And then they went a step further to say, "And it's also experience that our Black employees at Fenway experience." And I was not super, like mildly impressed, like a half step too impressed by this statement in the fact that it affirmed Torrey Hunter, but also because it recognized the abuse that their employees get at the very same stadium.
Yeah, and what all this reminds me of is that, you know, most people have an impression of sports in this country as being in the vanguard of social change. And it's even embedded deep in the psychology of Black athletes. We can even look back to 2016 when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee that August. From that point for the next several years, you could almost count on your fingers and toes how many Black athletes actually followed him in his protests, with the exception of one weekend when everyone responded to President Trump's calling them but it also got co-opted. Owners got involved in it. Jerry Jones pulled a little trick.
Jerry Jones and his Cowboys all taking a knee before the national anthem.
In what seemed a choreographed move, the team stood up, went to the sidelines, and linked arms for the Star-Spangled Banner alongside their...
So sports is this vanguard of social change. Really not true. Has been a laggard. And, you know, I would also argue, since we started out talking about the Confederate flag and Bubba Wallace, there's no corner of American society that has done more to promulgate Confederate imagery than sports. NASCAR, Southern College football.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I really appreciate you bringing up that one weekend where, you know, Jerry Jones got his photo op kneeling, because honestly, the last 2 weeks has kind of felt like that weekend, right? Where there was an interest convergence with multiple motivations coming to bear. Some of it sincere, others motivated by something else. And I keep waiting for it to pass, waiting for that Monday. And I think that thinking about what the actionable steps are, thinking about how we resist corporations becoming like Nike, and all of a sudden you have, you know, Colin in a video, no mention of police brutality, no mention of the kind of core central issues, but all of a sudden creating a space where you're buying Nikes, you're revolutionary. And that slippage is very easy. If the next step for NASCAR and MLB, et cetera, is another diversity and inclusion initiative, another false partnership where you're going to give all this money to an organization that's going to cut the dreads off of Black boys and call it progress, that's what's coming down the pipe. And so how do we take this moment and figure out how to guard against that and continue to push this moment of interest convergence towards where we want sports to be?
All right, Kevin, I think it's a good time to move on to your topic.
Yeah, well, that is kind of my topic. You know, the name of this show is really an oxymoron for people of color, right? You know, growing up in Washington, D.C., my father was a sports fan, my mother was a sports fan, but sports from a very early age, yeah, I wanted my local teams to win, but it was more than just a game. My father and his friends had boycotted the Washington football team in the late 1950s. They had season tickets and started going to watch Baltimore Colts games. And the reason was because the Washington football team had a racist owner who was determined to keep this team, the last all-white team, in the NFL. And there are black and white pictures of the Nazis with placards marching and in full uniform, marching outside of DC Stadium as it's being constructed, with placards imploring Washington to keep its football team all white. So I remember my father telling me stories about boycotting the games. And then once the team integrated, it continued to be drenched in the Confederate imagery that it used to sell itself to the South, because it was the southernmost team in the NFL at the time. And one of the things that they did was the band used to play Dixie, and it would sometimes bring out Confederate flags in the stands. And my father wrote a letter to the acting president of the team at the time, who was Edward Bennett Williams. My father pointed out to him this practice. He said, why are we celebrating a dead society? It's a slap in the face to black ticket buyers and sometimes causes fights in the stands. And to Edward Bennett Williams' credit, he wrote my father back and said, thank you for bringing that to my attention. We will end that practice right now. And to the best of my knowledge, Confederate imagery was removed from the home games of this team. So that's one to show that you can do the right thing and move ahead, but two to show just how important sports are to people of color. The imagery, this story about it being a meritocracy where the color of your skin doesn't matter. You know, as I've gotten older, I just can't sit down and just enjoy a game. I joke with some friends about, okay, let's watch this game without polemics. But it's hard to do because it means something particularly different to me as a person of color than I think to people who have been able to grow up with sports is just something to enjoy devoid of politics.
Yes, certainly. I think that historically it has occupied that space because of the possibilities. I'm thinking as a sports historian, of course, you know, Jack Johnson was so effective because at a time where scientific racism was rampant and you're saying black people are inferior in every aspect, you can't keep that same energy if Jack Johnson is knocking people out in the ring. I think about 68 a lot for a number of reasons, obviously, but I think about one of the things that black athletes were saying when they were thinking about boycotting because of the inclusion of South African Rhodesia, one of the biggest things that athletes, men and women, were saying was that we're not going to get an audience at the UN to talk about what's going on in our country. We're not going to get a press conference in the Rose Garden. But the one way that white America understands and sees black people is through sports, which occupies such a space in our society. So we're going to take this platform. We're going to take the moment that we know that they can't look away because they're cheering us on. And we're going to use that to speak out. This is our press conference. This is our moment in front of the UN. And so that platform that sports gives always compels it to be more than a game.
I tell you, one of the most obscure Hall of Fame speeches was given by one of the greatest tight ends of all time, Kellen Winslow Sr. The entire speech was about the need for affirmative action in sports, in football in particular. And Kellen's an old friend. I said, well, you know, man, why'd you do that? He said, well, I knew this was the last time anybody's going to listen to me. He recognized in the way that Cap recognized, in the way that Kevin's father recognized, that this vehicle is so important. The one story I thought about when you were talking about your father, Kevin, and you know, you're not going to make me cry in this on this show, was my grandfather, who was born in 1893 in Medicine Lodge, Kansas, and he came to live with us in the 60s, and he was a rabid Dodgers fan because of Jackie Robinson. And if anybody tipped me into rooting for the team with the most black players, rooting for the team with the black coach, for seeing sport is good when it treats us the right way, it was from my grandfather. And the Jack, you know, Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, those moments and all the stories, especially the Louis of people on the stoop listening to the Louis Schmeling fights and all that sort of stuff, was really just a part of our culture and a part of our unity that in many ways had us over buy into sport and over buy into this success story. You know, we can make it, and look, somebody made it, you know, Jackie made it. So I always say we have to be very careful about how we use sport, how we accept sport as a space for success, especially today with all this going on, with all this activity, with all the power LeBron has. LeBron will not be on that platform forever. There'll be a day when he's not playing anymore. The most vivid picture in sport, and I used to have it kind of posted on my wall all the time, was the day that Michael Jordan got fired from the Washington Wizards. When he wasn't playing, the ownership said, you know, we don't really need you anymore. It can happen to anybody in sport at any time, and that's kind of how we fit within sport. And I didn't cry.
Kevin, do you want to wrap it up?
This has been a fabulous conversation, important conversation. Because there's a lot of noise out there about what's going on right now and what sports mean. I think everybody here really brought the importance of this moment, brought it out, and underscored the fact that there's still so much more to do. this is just the beginning. There's a lot still to be done with this conversation.
Wow, that was amazing. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Penn State professor and Burn It All Down co-host Amira Rose Davis, Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University, and The Washington Post's Kevin Blackstone. Thanks again to all of you.
Thank you always for having me.
Thanks, Kieran.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
There was a lot more to that conversation that we just didn't have time for in the show. So we're going to release a longer version, twice as long, as a podcast bonus. You can find it now in the Only a Game feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Stefania Ergamlitsa wanted to bring a portable basketball hoop to Minneapolis as a way to ease tensions. But there was a problem.
Flights, easy. Hotel, easy. How in the world do I get a basketball hoop to Minneapolis?
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Protests over racial injustice are spreading across the country while a pandemic continues to take its toll. The next weeks and months are leading to a consequential election this November. And every day, the NPR Politics podcast is here to discuss how it could reshape your world.
I'm Karen Given. Coming soon on Only a Game, The Myth of Meritocracy, a special episode examining the ways sports perpetuate inequality and systemic racism. But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
You might have noticed that ESPN has sounded a bit different lately. In the weeks after the killing of George Floyd, ESPN personalities have spoken up in ways that most definitely would have gotten them suspended or fired in the past. Here's Michael Eaves on SportsCenter.
I almost didn't come to work tonight because some of the reaction to recent events reminded me that there are several people watching me right now who feel that the color of my skin makes me less worthy of basic human rights and dignity. And the thought of providing those people with news and entertainment literally made me sick to my stomach.
Industry watchers now say that ESPN's stick to sports policy is effectively dead. What do you make of all this?
That's another change that was wrought by the incredible events of the last 2 weeks. It was never tenable. It was never going to survive. It made the network look incredibly stupid. It wasn't as entertaining as it used to be.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing the embrace the debate thing, but, you know, you're only embracing debate on the designated hitter rule. It's ridiculous.
I do wonder if, when this moment passes, ESPN president Jimmy Pitaro is going to try to go back to his stick to sports mantra. It sounds like you think that wouldn't be successful.
No, I think it would fail miserably. You know, I think a lot of Rubicons have been crossed the last 3 weeks. And I don't think there's going to be any coming back from this.
After we spoke last week, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell released a video saying that the league had been wrong for not listening to players earlier and that Black lives do, in fact, matter. This week, New Orleans Saints safety Malcolm Jenkins said Goodell's statement didn't go far enough. Here he is on CBS.
Until they apologize specifically to Colin Kaepernick or sign him to a team, I don't think that they will end up on the right side of history. At the end of the day,
so what are the chances the NFL ends up on the right side of history as far as Kaepernick is concerned?
Well, first of all, Karen, it was obviously our conversation last week that pushed Goodell into changing his mind.
Clearly.
Because as we know, he's a regular Only a Game listener. No, I mean, Malcolm Jenkins is right. This was a good start. The problem is, on issues like this, generally, a good start is considered enough by the people who aren't on the sharp end of the stick. So faith without works is dead. Let's see what happens going forward.
In a plan announced on Thursday, the Texas Collegiate League will begin play on July 3rd. Fans will be allowed in the stadium at 50% capacity. I love baseball, but I don't think I'm going to be standing in line to go in. You?
No, and I don't think very many other people are either. It's a nice league. It's very similar to the Cape Cod League we have up where we are. It's a good idea. It's an opportunity for all these players. But it's going to take a long time for people to rework their brains into feeling safe at sports events.
More details are emerging about the return of the NBA, Charlie. And since I know you're concerned about watching games with no fans, I've got good news for you. According to The Athletic, the NBA is in negotiations with the makers of NBA 2K to use fan noise from the video game. Problem solved, right?
Oh, my God. Really? This is awful. I mean, this is worse than the golf tournaments that pipe in bird songs. Do they think that people aren't going to notice that the stands are empty, but people are still cheering? Or are they going to fill the stands with CGI fans?
Maybe.
I should not give them ideas like that, actually, now that I think about it. That was probably a bad move right there.
In other news, according to a memo acquired by the Daily Beast, reporters who want to cover the return of the NBA might have to agree to stay inside the league's Disney World bubble for 3.5 months. The article made it sound like this would be a hardship, but I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's not a bad place to stay. It's air conditioned. I mean, it's Florida in the summer, but it's air conditioned. I don't know what the rules will be in terms of going to other parts of Disney World.
Right.
You know, can you like go to Disney World? Are you stuck? Or is it arena hotel every day? Because that could get a little old, even at Disney World.
And finally, Charlie, next weekend, Northampton Town plays in the first leg of the League Two semifinal. Fans will not be allowed in the stadium, but that does not mean that players will not have a friendly face. And that friendly face is Shaquille O'Neal. Explain, please.
Well, they're going to put a cardboard cutout in the stands of Shaq wearing the home team colors and the scarf. And it's described, and I love this because this is one of those great things about English sports, Shaq will be a cobbler in the crowd. I don't know what that means. Does it mean he's making shoes? Does it mean he's making dessert? I have no idea.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
It was about a week ago that Stefania Ergomlitsa had an idea. She wanted to take a portable basketball hoop to protest sites in Minneapolis. It was something she had done before in Philadelphia, where she lives.
This is how I've seen in the past. I've been able to bring people together. I thought, why not try it now, you know?
Despite the pandemic, Stefania figured it was worth the risk. But there was one aspect of her trip that was going to be difficult to arrange on short notice.
You know, I'm looking like, okay, flights, easy. Hotel, easy. How in the world do I get a basketball hoop to Minneapolis?
After a search, Stefania found a new unassembled hoop and checked it through oversized luggage.
So it's actually not as crazy as it sounds, but you definitely get some weird looks going into the airport when you have like a giant box and on the front cover of the box is just like a basketball hoop picture. Everybody's kind of giving you this look like, what are you doing?
So before we talk about how this all got started, I don't want to give people the impression that you think that a basketball hoop is going to solve systemic racism.
Yeah.
What is it that you're trying to do here?
Obviously, basketball is not going to solve the problem. We were more looking towards trying to ease the tension so that way there can be room for change. There can be room for communication. So that way maybe messages can get across. We saw protesters come and be excited that we were there with our hoop, you know, have like a little brightness during like a really dark time right now, you know. On the opposite side, on the police end as well, having them come and like be part of the community again was something that I think is worth having at this period of time, you know, moving forward towards a more positive future.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's go back and talk about how this all started. And we might as well start at the beginning. You were not supposed to grow up to be a person who was good at playing basketball, right?
No. I was actually born with a foot and leg condition where both of my legs were completely turned in. I'm missing bones in both of my feet and my like Achilles tendon is too short. And they told my parents, you know, she will never be able to walk. She'll never be able to play sports, never run, nothing. And so they actually put casts on my legs for the first 3 years of my life to straighten them. And then at that point, they put me through, you know, tons of therapy, lots of tears, lots of pain. And they were like, okay, you know, maybe we can get her walking at this point, but no sports, no like running, nothing. And my parents didn't really like that answer, you know, so they put me into every sport possible. And I was in pain a lot. I still to this day am in a lot of pain when I do physical activity. I don't remember the last time I've played on non-sprained ankles. Like I always have some sort of injury. But throughout my life, it's just been like, does it hurt? Yeah. But like, do I want to do it? Is it something I love? Is it worth it to me? Yes. And really, that's kind of how I've gotten to the spot that I'm at today. Now I carry basketball hoops around cities and I play with guys in the street. So if I can do it, anybody can do it, you know?
All right. So this dragging basketball hoops around cities did not begin in the past couple of weeks. So When and why did you start doing this?
Yeah, so I started back last year, last July probably, because I make content.
What's up? It's Steph here.
So I do Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Twitch.
We're going to go and try cheesesteaks. So everybody knows the great Philly debate, which cheesesteak is the best?
It mostly started off as like, oh, I think this would be fun. Like, I found a basketball hoop that was like $120 or something like that. Called up my video guy and I was like, hey, I ordered a basketball hoop. And he was like, okay. And I was like, yeah, we're gonna carry it around Philly and just play ball with people in the street. And I quickly hung up after that because I didn't want him to tell me no, you know. So he showed up. Like, luckily he showed up.
Today we're gonna go play basketball in Center City with our portable hoop.
It was really cool. Like, it was a really cool experience because people of all different, like, ethnicities, races, ages, gender, like, walks of life, like, everybody was just, like, kind of hanging around. Like, either they were cheering or they just wanted to be part of the environment or they wanted to play, you know? And it just was really cool to see how, like, the community came together through the sport of basketball. And so I figured I'd continue doing it. We had a whole tour planned, like to go across the US and do this everywhere. And then like Corona hit and it was kind of like, okay, let me retire the hoop until this is all over.
Continuing to monitor the scene in Minneapolis tonight where protesters taking the streets, demonstrating against the killing of George Floyd.
You know, when all of this kind of erupted the past few weeks.
Protests in cities large and small, and these protests have extended around the world.
I wanted to do something bigger, like something more with my platform. I didn't want to just make that, you know, that post that everybody's making where it's like, you know, this is what I think about the situation at hand. It was kind of like, regardless of everything else happening, like, this is what I need to do.
So on Monday, June 1st, you were looking for a spot to set up a hoop in downtown Philly. What happened?
I hadn't seen the damage yet from like all the lootings and everything. And so, you know, put on my running shoes, put on my running clothes, everything. Went for a run to go check it out, tried to like catch up with the protesters, see like where they're at, like how things are progressing. And I like get to a point where I catch up to them. And I'm just like, at first, like I'm running, right? And I'm thinking, maybe I'm just really out of shape. Like, you know, maybe like I just haven't run in a long time. Like I can't breathe right now. You know, like I felt like my air pipes were not getting the right air, you know? And so I smell smoke, like maybe they're burning something weird. And then it hits me in my head, you know, police just let off these like tear gas bombs, you know? And these people were just peacefully walking. At that point, I was just like, I was very angry and I came home and I made that video.
I just got back. I'm looking like this. I'm a little bit heated.
At that point in my head, it was just like, this can't just be like me going around with my basketball hoop.
After seeing what I saw today, it can no longer just be a portable hoop video. It is officially a basketball peaceful protest. Because I saw them tear gas a whole crowd of people today for peacefully, non-violently walking.
Let me go and really try to do what I can to like reunite my city so that we can move forward and we can work together to like move forward.
I hope to see y'all. That's all I gotta say. I hope to see y'all and bye.
So that first Tuesday morning when you brought out the hoop in Philly, what was going through your head as you walked out with it?
I was so nervous. Oh, man. I called my friend. I was like, I don't know. Like, maybe I shouldn't do this. Like, I'm nauseous right now. Like, I feel like I'm going to throw up. Like, this, I don't know if this is the right decision or not. Because, you know, it's a very sensitive time. And it's, I didn't want the wrong message to come across. How do we do this in a way where it's not distracting from protests? How do I bring people together and show that we are like a united community, you know? So I was so nervous. And then when we got out there, I was like, okay, this is good. It went really well. We brought protesters together. We brought police together, you know, civilians, everybody. The next day we went out again and people were like, we love what you're doing. You know, like it was cool to see how like the community received us and received us in a positive way. There's always going to be people that have a problem with what you're doing. People were like, why are you playing with the police? But it's like the end of the day, the amount of positive that we're getting significantly outweighs the like very few negative.
Well, let's talk about playing with police. How do you get them to play with you? And why is that an effort that you do specifically?
You know, everybody talks about white privilege. When I'm going up to police officers, I know that, like, I look very harmless. It's like this little white girl is carrying a basketball hoop with her. Like, what could she possibly do wrong? You know, and that's a wrong mentality, right? Like, that shouldn't be how the mentality is. But I'm aware that that's what it is, right? So it's like, do you want to play? Like, you want to play? Come on, like, play me 1v1, you know? At the end of the day, police are supposed to be the ones protecting you. Right. Once we do fix the system, if there's still this, like, tension between police and civilian, like, that's not helpful to the community. We need that to be gone, too.
And then you decided it was time to take this beyond Philadelphia. Take me through that decision.
Friday night, I'm sitting there, I'm like, I think I should go to Minneapolis. I knew it worked in our city, and I just wanted to see if we could try to recreate it there as well. You know, that's where I felt like maybe that was like the place that needed it most at the time. But honestly, like when we got out there, they were already, they're already doing their thing. There's a big cookout. They have like food drives, like grocery food that you can take for free, water, juices, drinks, whatever. We're just like playing basketball with everybody and everybody's happy. And it was really cool to see how their community is healing during this time. And in my opinion, it was really beautiful to see that because the media paints things in a way where it shows you that like everything is negative. They showed all the lootings, but I had no idea this was happening in Minneapolis. At the end of the day, it's like, yeah, maybe we didn't have to ease any tension there, but I'm actually really happy about that. And like, we just got to be part of the community.
Stefania Ergenlitza, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.